It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And this is Spy Talk. Karen Greenberg is traveling today, can't be with us, sorry to say. The big news this week is not exactly intelligence-oriented, but this spectacular, I don't know what you call it, conclave of generals in Quantico yesterday. It made me think that Pete Hegseth's concentration on grooming and beards and so on, that his inspiration for this is drawn from Saving Private Ryan, not the current reality of military forces, especially in the intelligence realm, where it's about nerds and button pushing, drones and so on. We're not talking about hand-to-hand combat like it is in the movies. What do you say, Mike?
Well, I agree, but that's certainly not Pete Hegseth's perspective on the world. I mean, you know, what he gave was this sort of, you know, anti-woke rant that you know, I'm sure he had rehearsed many times as a Fox News host. But, you know, there was something that struck me. I mean, his point, America's warriors kill people and break things for a living. And that's the spirit that he wanted to convey. And I was struck, this is in a column in the Bulwark today, about a message that somebody from a former military commander who was with a group called Veterans for Responsible Leadership posted after Hegseth's talk. And I just want to read a little from it. This is a disgraceful message. There was a soldier that I served with in the army that later was killed in Mosul, Iraq, that said the reason he joined the military was because he believed it was the greatest force for good that the world has ever known. He said the military not only taught its soldiers to be lethal, but it also taught us to be compassionate and empathetic and care about not only the American people, but also freedom-loving and seeking people from all over the globe. This is the true warrior ethos that so many of us veterans know and love. I'm thinking about him a lot tonight, and we'll be damned if sons of bitches like Trump and Hegseth will transform our great military into something resembling the Russians.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see what the general reaction is from the generals and the commanders over time. I mean, we're going to end up with a 7 days in May kind of situation where Trump orders military units into domestic disturbances or protests in America. That seems to be what he's saying. And I think the number of military commanders may resent and reject that advice. So I think we're heading down a unknown territory here.
Small correction, in 7 days in May, it was the general plotting against the president, not the president plotting against the generals.
But it is
one of my favorite movies.
I used to say, midway through the first Trump administration, I say there'll come a time when liberals will be crying out for a military coup.
Yeah.
So anyway, we are in some uncharted territory here. But meanwhile, we got the government shutdown, and this does affect some intelligence operations. I mean, people are still going to show up, are showing up today at CIA, and they're running operations. They're unhindered. It's really the back room, so to speak, at CIA, which will be furloughed, they're non-essential personnel and so on. But operations will continue. per usual. However, according to an interview I did yesterday with Larry Pfeiffer, a former senior CIA officer, 32 years, he once ran the White House Situation Room, that critical Pentagon intelligence operations may be shut down. This is, we're talking about the National Security Agency, the National Geospatial Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Some of these intelligence collection programs are going to be shut down, according to guidance, the public guidance that was put out this week. So,
and this is the agency that is on the front lines of tracking and resisting and fighting back against cyber attacks, which, you know, have, you know, they may not be headlines as much as they used to be, but they are continuing methodically, systematically. The Chinese salt typhoon. You know, it's a, that is a code name that every American should know. It's the it's the hacker, the Chinese hacker group that has penetrated American power
everything.
Grids and companies, stealing sensitive files, intellectual property such as chip designs. New York Times did an article, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. Unrestrained Chinese cyber attackers may have stolen data from almost every American.
They're in our all telecommunications companies.
Right, right. Wow. And the agency that is supposed to keep track of this is, what, 65% shutting down with this shutdown?
Yeah, and the legislation authorizing it sunsetted last night, as Karen Greenberg reported today at Spy Talk over at our newsletter site. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, more confusion, more disarray, more darkness. And we'll see how that plays out.
We've got a great guest today, don't we?
We do. David McCloskey is our guest. We're so happy to have him. If you haven't encountered a David McCloskey novel, you are missing something if you are a Spy Talk fan, because he has been anointed the successor to John Le Carre, and boy, does he carry that out. He gets into the interior mindset of intelligence officers. The material for the Persians, as suggested by the title, is about intelligence operations, Israeli intelligence operations inside Iran.
And he knows that world. He's a former CIA analyst himself, focused on the Middle East. So it's going to be a great discussion.
So we're thrilled to have him. And without further ado, let's go to the interview. David McCloskey, it is our great pleasure to welcome you to Spy Talk. Your previous work has generated observations from many clinics that you are the successor to John Le Carre. That's a pretty heavy burden.
Big shoes to fill there, David.
Well, the good news is first off, thank you for having me on. It's really a privilege to be here. I will say I'm heartened because I'm not attempting to fill the shoes. So,
of course,
that makes it easier. Even if those kind of comparisons are useful for marketing purposes, I generally find them in private. Preposterous, but I'm always happy for any useful comparison that helps sell novels. Well, this novelist will take.
Yeah, well, those are the magic words, John Le Carre. And you know, you set that tone, you set the comparison to Le Carre right away in your opening scene, where the victim, you humanize the victim of an Israeli assassination operation. You know, in the lesser hands of someone, this would be a comic book style bad guy, but you portray him as a family guy. He's got a nice wife and children, and he's just going to work and boom, he's gone. So that was an important decision right off the bat in your plot. Why did you start that way?
So, you know, I'm really interested in characters that are actually like humans that aren't cartoons. And I find that, you know, most of us are not all good or all bad. Most of us are not sort of comic book villains, right? Even people who are working in the Iranian intelligence services or security apparatus, in the case of this novel, The Persian, for the most part, you know, they're people who are doing a job, who have some sort of vague sense of patriotism, who might not like the government that they serve, but don't really see other options, and who have families that they love. You know, they love their wives, they love their children, they love their moms and dads. And as a novelist, you know, when you're dealing with characters like that, you got a lot of grist, because you have people who are conflicted, like we all are. You have people who are in situations where they maybe don't have a lot of agency. They feel trapped. And you have people who also reflect, you know, things that we know are true about ourselves. Like, most of us love our kids, love our families, you know? And when you set someone like that up right away in the book, and I think there's no spoilers here, obviously it's chapter one, you know, to get killed. And then his widow, who will become a very big player in the story, you know, sort of is left reeling from that. You have a much more interesting story, I think, than if this guy is like a, you know, psychotic baddie. And look, as a writer, I mean, sometimes I like a good psychotic baddie in a book. I mean, those people do exist. You can draw them effectively. But I think in this story, whether you're looking at the kind of official Iranian side or the Israeli side, or you're looking at the asset that the Israelis are running, it was important to me to try to generate, you know, really a humane psychological portrait of all these people, and how a lot of people that we can relate to would find themselves locked in a death struggle with each other.
The same goes for your main character, Kamran Esfahani, who's described as an Iranian dentist living out a dreary existence in Stockholm.
You may have written the first spy novel in which the main character is a dentist.
Yeah, but I was thinking, what a great cover. You know, he goes back to Tehran. He's an Iranian exile returning to the motherland. And who gets a closer look at the clientele than a dentist looking into the mouth of Iranian officials? So I thought that was a great idea. Was it inspired by anything in real life, the cover of a dentist?
No. So it was the way this character started was that I wanted somebody who could be kind of a con man, who even if he kind of isn't like your typical picture of a con man, he had a lot of the skills and talents and proclivities that a con man would have. And I wanted him to feel trapped as well, you know, and that a lot of his sort of impulses or desires to, you know, sort of profit himself, to trick others, would arise from this feeling of just being bored and stuck.
Right.
And I thought, who's more bored than a dentist? Apologies to any dentists out there, but I thought I could see how you could get really sick of that job really quickly.
And his motivation, I love too. It's like, it's again, not a comic book character. His motivation isn't to bring down the evil Iranian regime. He's trying to earn money from Mossad so he can get to California.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a California dream, you know, and who can't relate? Who can't relate to that? You're a guy, you have a failing dental practice in Stockholm. You've got a pretty tense relationship with your brother. You know, your mom has kind of late stage dementia and is not well. You don't have a lot of money. You're sick of the winter. And an Israeli recruiter shows up, not on your doorstep, but actually in your dental chair, with an offer that you maybe can't refuse, but also don't want to. And you have this kind of mix of mirth and menace in his recruitment that I found fun to work with, of like, he's kind of threatened, but he's also being asked to do something where he'll earn some real money.
It's a great character.
Jumps at the chance. Yeah. Jumps at the chance.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, you know, I said this is the first spy novel to have a dentist as the main character. But, you know, I remember in my many years covering intel matters, you know, you would always get the phone calls from people saying that the CIA has wired my teeth.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I just wondered if you had thought of that, you know, paradigm when you were creating this particular character, the dentist who becomes a spy.
I think he jokes at one point about fitting someone with some exploding fillings or something like that, you know. So the idea of sort of elaborate gadgetry and dental work was not far from my mind as I was writing his character.
And you interviewed Mossad officers as part of your research, correct?
I did. Yeah, I attempted to recruit as many Mossad formers as I could to talk to me. And
did you have success?
I did. I had success. Recruiting. I had success. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting feature now of being a novelist that, for no real personal benefit, a lot of people who have worked in various secret services are willing to talk to you because they want to talk, you know, and they want to talk with someone who they know is not. I'm not a journalist. I'm not writing a scoop. I don't want any real stories. I want to bounce ideas off of these people and help understand. I think in particular for me, you know, I had a lot of interactions with the Mossad in a liaison capacity when I was at the CIA, but right. not really in a how do they work operationally point of view. And there's a tendency, of course, when you sit down to write, to mirror image, you know, your own intelligence service onto a foreign actor, right? So like my mental model to start for the Mossad was the CIA. And so I wanted to talk to Mossad officers who would help me understand where is that mental model correct? And then where does it really depart from reality? How is your service different from ours culturally from a tradecraft perspective? And so they were really useful in bouncing those kind of ideas off of and really getting an understanding of the differences between the two services.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with Scott Anderson. And we're back.
So look, congrats on The Persian. It really is a great read. And this is what, your fourth
spy novel since you left the CIA. And, you know, what one thing that's so gripping about,
this is the second of your books I've read. I read the last one about the mole hunt at the CIA for a Russian mole. The reader knows, you know what you're talking about, and it's your authenticity as a former CIA analyst to be able to write how the spy world works. So I'd like to ask you a little bit about your career in the CIA. I was listening to your podcast the other day, The Rest is Classified, in which you talked a little bit about how when you joined the CIA as an intern, and as an intern, you were writing PDBs for the President of the United States, which
President Stanley Brief.
So tell us, just walk us through and tell us what you can about your years at the CIA.
Yeah, so I was recruited in 2006. I was a sophomore in college at the time. I was studying international relations. I had vague ideas that I would get a job after graduation that would allow me to sort of travel and understand the world. I liked reading about global politics, history, grew up reading spy novels and techno thrillers. So I think I had this sort of impulsive desire to learn more about the world and how it functioned, but that had not been connected at any point in time prior to the CIA showing up on campus with any specific idea that I would go work at the CIA. But when they showed up, a recruiter showed up and came to my international politics class, you know, I was really intrigued, obviously. It felt like it kind of harmonized the things that I was interested in with an actual practical job. I also thought there's no way I would get in, you know. I mean, thought, okay, well, I will be one candidate among thousands. But I applied, got the conditional offer, you know, went through all the psych background, you know, polygraph, all that kind of stuff. And joined in the summer of 2006 as an analyst working on Syria. Did that for two summers because they get you a full top secret, you know, TSSCI clearance, and then you work for a couple summers. And then if you haven't totally screwed up, they tend to give you a job. And I did not totally screw up. I got a full-time job. I joined when I graduated in 2008. And it really just gotten hooked during my summers on the work and found that, you know, It was for someone who likes to learn and for someone who likes to understand how things really actually work in practice, having access to a bunch of classified intelligence on the Syrian regime, you know, is a way to sort of lived out that, you know, fantasy in real time and kind of get a sense of, oh, this is what we read in the papers, but then this is actually what's going on behind the scenes. That's really an intoxicating thing. So I was an analyst on Syria pretty much the whole time, working from Langley, working from field stations in the region, and absolutely loved the work of being an analyst, you know, which of course, as you guys know, is not so much like the movies, but was fascinating to me.
But this was right through the Syrian civil war.
Yes.
When the rebellion against the Assad regime began in 2011 with the Arab Spring. So you were the Syria or one of the top Syria analysts during this period?
Well, you know, it's funny when you say I was definitely not the
right.
And yeah. And I mean, I guess I was one of a team of Syria analysts who at that point in time, there just weren't that many, you know, at the CIA, because
right.
Syria up until 2011 was this topic where it was like a one PDB a year country up to that point, where there something would inevitably happen during the year that would justify somebody on the team of like five people writing a PDB. But it usually went to one of the more senior people, and the topics, you know, oftentimes it was actually, to my great consternation, you know, sometimes you would write a PDB, think it was meet PDB threshold, and then in the late stage of review, someone up the chain would kill it and say, let's just make this a WIRE, which stands for World Intelligence Review, and does not go to the president's desk. And he'd be like, ah, damn it. You know, I stayed up late writing this thing, and I got, you know, it got killed. That all changed.
I know what that's like.
Well, yeah. This is all fascinating, but I want to get back to the book and Mossad in Iraq. Now, I have two questions. One, is it realistic to say that actual Mossad officers, not sources, not their spies, but Mossad officers go in and out of Iran, as you posit in the book? And two, why doesn't the CIA do it?
So, the answer to that question is yes, they do it. It is much more rare than I demonstrate in the novel. And the CIA does it too, but it's also extremely rare. And you just think about the reality of it, right? And this is something that I talked endlessly about with my Mossad contacts, because from a storytelling standpoint, I have to get some of my senior, and I don't want to give anything away, but as the book, you know, as we sort of get to the culmination of the story, I'm going to pack a much weaker storytelling punch if I do not put my senior Mossad officers, main characters, on the ground in Iran for this final kind of showdown, right? That would be storytelling malpractice. To do so in real life would also be tradecraft malpractice, because they would almost certainly prefer, in most cases, to use an agent, an asset, you know, usually one of actually Iranian origin, right? Who can more easily operate in Iran, go in and out of Iran, and frankly, for whom the Mossad are much, you know, considered much more expendable. So they're going to be, it'd be very special circumstances, I think, where Mossad would actually put an officer into Iran, but it happens.
And you know, as you point out, there is a large Iranian Jewish population that emigrated to Israel over the years and still maintains contacts in the home country. And by the way, you know, you say it's rare, but it's done. I don't know if you've ever watched the TV show Tehran.
Oh, sure.
Which parallels a lot in your book. But there, it's the spy game. The Iranians versus the Mossad. But I want to ask you about two scenes, or one scene in the book that I think has so many larger implications for all of us. In the book, two Israeli assets are assassinated by the Iranians with a drone attack. And it seems to me, you know, when you combine drones with AI, this is the future of warfare. It's the future of espionage. It's metastasizing in so many ways. I mean, the Russia-Ukraine war is now mainly a drone war. And I just
wondered about, you know, the implications of that for the CIA, for U.S. intelligence, for the Pentagon in as we go forward, because this is the way the game is being played right now.
Yeah, I was fascinated with this piece of the story as well, because I don't think it's giving anything too terribly away that basically what I've done in the book is, you know, going back to 2007, the Israelis have on again, off again, conducted targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists, military officials, engineers, right? What I tried to do is kind of flip that on its head and say, what if the Iranians were able to do that inside Israel? And what if it was not a terrorist attack, as we might conceive it, where you're trying to hit a civilian infrastructure, hit a ball, hit a restaurant, but to kill very specific people in the way that the Israelis do it inside Iran. And so I thought about, well, how would that happen? And when you start to dig into how the Iranians recruit in Israel, because they do, I mean, if you look at, just look at Shin Bet, the Israeli internal security agency, over the past couple of years, they've arrested dozens of Israeli citizens on suspicion of conducting espionage for Iran, and not just collecting foreign intelligence, but actually doing things like trying to set forests on fire, conducting vandalism, distributing propaganda, attempting to kill an Israeli businessman, putting severed animal heads on people's doorsteps to intimidate them. So there is a precedent here for the Iranians doing things inside Israel. But I thought, how would I get to targeting specific intelligence officers and doing it in a way where your support asset network on the ground inside Israel wouldn't be compromised by the operation? Because if you shot somebody, if you go up and stab them, you know, there's a lot of ways you could try to kill somebody where it's really likely that the Israeli police or internal security apparatus is going to catch you, right? Mm. The drone thing is an interesting way to get around that, because you can basically set up a satellite link. If you have someone on the ground who's able to emplace that drone, that kamikaze drone, if you have smuggled explosives that you're able to link to the drone to turn it into a weapon, and if you have some creative but not, you know, very plausible concealment devices that you can use to place those drones in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv, and if you have some knowledge, as the Iranians certainly would, of the camera networks in these places, it's not implausible to think that if you've been able to recruit a few people inside Israel who may not even know what they're doing to move something from point A to point B, you could then fly that thing from Iran via satellite uplink and use it to conduct targeted killings. So for me, the drone piece of this, you know, you're absolutely right. It's become a feature of the state-to-state conflict in Russia, Ukraine. But for me, in this world of sort of targeted assassinations, it became a very plausible tool that a state would use in a really hardened security environment inside Israel to try to conduct a killing and preserve your support asset network, which in this case in Israel is super valuable. So I think there's a lot of intel and targeted killing applications for these things. And I hope no one uses the book as a how-to manual as a result, I should say that.
It raises the possibility that the Iranian operatives might be able to carry out a targeted killing here. We know from previous reporting that they have targeted John Bolton and others, and even Trump himself during the campaign.
Yeah.
There was a plot reportedly designed to blow up, who was it, the Saudi ambassador in a Georgetown nightclub?
Adel Al-Jaber. No, it was Cafe Milano.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So, a known CIA hangout.
But, yes, very. I love Cafe Milano. I love that place. I'm glad it wasn't blown to pieces by the Iranians.
Yeah. And we've had lots of mysterious drone sightings over American towns, military bases, and so on, that as far as I know, no one's come to a persuasive explanation for. So, and this gets into UFO territory and so on.
It does, anyway, it does, yeah.
Stories are character driven. Your character of Eric Glitzman, the chief of the clandestine unit inside Tehran, is a fascinating portrait. Tell us about him and what made you draw him the way you did.
Yeah. So Eric Glitzman is the chief of something called the Caesarea Division inside Mossad, which is a real or was a real bureaucratic entity inside the place. And I've sort of adopted it as the Mossad entity that is responsible for sowing chaos inside Iran. And I'm not sure if it's still functioning. One of the things that my Mossad contacts were very reluctant to tell me about or to even speak of was specific names of kind of like how is the place actually organized. They're very cagey about that. And I would say in general, okay, the Mossad guys were much cagier than their American counterparts when describing how their service functions, which makes
classic
sense. Yeah. So Glitzman is an Ashkenazi Jew who is I describe him at one point as a loving yet absentee father. He is a fearsome yet elegant operational planner. He is a devoted husband who's also extremely agitated all the time with his wife. And he is a kind of loving, almost father figure in some ways to our dentist, who he recruits. And
which
yet
case
he is also
officers,
yeah, and he's extremely manipulative too. Right, exactly. And Glitzman as I was reading more about Meir Dagan and the way Meir Dagan, who is a former head of Assad, who's since passed, but who was the chief of Mossad at this very formative period in the early 2000s when the Israelis started killing people in Iran. Meir Dagan believed that you had to kill to save lives, and that if you kill Iranian scientists, you decrease the odds of the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon, and that decreases the odds of an open conflict with the Iranians where tens of thousands of people, if not more, would die. And so he came up with this, you know, his idea of killing to save lives. And Eric Glitzman, I've just sort of glued that onto him because Glitzman is in some ways ambivalent about the way the Israelis are approaching their own security in the region. Like, I think he understands some of the self-defeating strategies that the government has employed. And yet at the same time, he doesn't see any path out but to kill a lot of the people who are opposing the Israeli state and seek to do it harm. And so he is he's instrumental in this book because in many ways he kind of represents, he represents an agglomeration of what I would describe as kind of the way that a lot of Mossad people, when they look at the region, would think about the world, which is different from the way like Benjamin Netanyahu or some of the far right members of his coalition would view the world. But Glitzman is kind of at the heart of it, a practical man who is not a devil and not an angel either.
Explain that difference between the Mossad view of the world and the way politicians, and in particular Netanyahu, view it.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I think
has Glitzman, a lot to do with geography.
Yeah, well, I think Glitzman, you know, he works on Iran, and he has an understanding, I think, that in many ways, there shouldn't be a significant dispute between the Israeli state and the Iranian people, or the Israeli people and the Iranian people. And in fact, he's got, you know, one of his closest deputies, a woman named Rivka Sadegh, is a Persian Jew herself. You know, he works with a lot of Persians inside Mossad. And I think he sees his fight with Iran not as a struggle between two peoples, but as a struggle between, you know, sort of Israel and a small group of Iranians inside the regime who have this psychotic millenarian view, apocalyptic view of their role in the region and seek to destroy the Israeli state. And so he wants to undermine that regime as much as he can. But when he, you know, there's a scene in the novel where he's napping with his daughter Oriana, and he's kind of reflecting a bit on the world that she's going to inherit. She's five in the book. You know, and he's incredibly saddened and dismayed by what he sees going on, in particular in the conflict with the Palestinians, which is not a subject of this novel, but is weighing on his psyche, I think, very much, even as his responsibilities take him elsewhere. And I think in that sense, he doesn't carry with him a desire to sort of entirely subjugate and control the land that these Palestinians claim, but is hopeful in some way that there can be, you know, a sort of better way for the Israelis in the region. But he's unable, I think, to really articulate what that might look like. I think that's what positions him as a little bit different from the more kind of Netanyahuist or far right types in the Israeli government today.
Is there a takeaway here? And this is not nonfiction. It's not a textbook. It's a novel.
Yeah.
Could you say that one of the takeaways is that an intelligence agency, a state, can become drunk with its own success?
Yeah, I certainly did not. You know, you make a great point. Like, I didn't. Someone picking up this book, there's no morality play in here. You know, there's really not. I mean, I think you can walk with these characters through the story and look at the decisions that they make and probably come to very different conclusions, right, about what should or shouldn't happen in the Middle East and how justified the Israelis might be with respect to what they do inside Iran and all this kind of stuff, right? And there are some poignant conversations, I think, of the novel about that, that kind of set the Israeli perspective against the Iranian one, and the reader can be the judge. But I do think there is something to that point that the Israelis, and you know, say throughout this novel, are able to do things inside Iran almost at will, you know, much like in real life. And I think it's safe to say that there's a big question mark around the strategic value of those operations and whether they're able to turn those operations into better political outcomes. And I think that the lack of that direct connection is one where you could say, look, you could be drunk on operational or tactical success and not able to use it to then achieve the big picture things that you want to achieve.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with Scott Anderson. And we're back.
I don't know when you started writing the novel, but certainly the pager operation last year that decimated Hezbollah, you know, followed by the attacks inside Iran, including further assassinations of top nuclear scientists, were major successes for Mossad. I mean, particularly the pager operation and Hezbollah, they basically, you know, undermined and severely weakened their principal military enemy, a point you made on in your two-part series on The Rest Is Classified about the pager operation. And so how to explain the amazing, and I would say in the case of the pager operation, strategic success of the Israelis, and you know, the complete mess they've made in Gaza, where, you know, they've turned most of the world against them, which is a strategic blow for Israel in its international standing.
Yeah,
how do you reconcile, you know, brilliant success with what seems like, you know, failure?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the objectives, if we were to contrast, and I'm doing some of this thinking in real time, so I mean, please, you know, interject or build on it. But I think if you contrast the objectives with their war against Hezbollah and the war against Hamas, you know, you get to two pretty different outcomes, which they have, right? I mean, if you are let's take Hezbollah. If you're attempting to utterly degrade Hezbollah's command and control infrastructure so that it's not even capable of fighting back once you unleash a massive air assault on it, but at the same time, you have no real desire to govern Beirut, you don't claim portions of your sort of political establishment and electoral base don't really claim Beirut as your own turf or territory. You're just trying to defang a military opponent. That kind of tactical or operational brilliance, I think, can more easily be converted into a strategic gain. And I think you're absolutely right that there was a strategic victory over Hezbollah. The pager attacks were the opening salvo. There was a 10-12-day air campaign afterward that culminated in the killing of Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary of General of Hezbollah. But very much unlike the conflict in 2006, the Israelis this time got into Hezbollah's command and control infrastructure and destroyed it and decapitated its leadership, decimated its leadership, and achieved that strategic outcome, which was basically how do you deter and set back Hezbollah militarily so that it cannot attack you in the north. I think that was largely accomplished, at least for the time being. If you contrast those objectives with, you know, Gaza, where right off the bat, you have a conflict between trying to militarily degrade Hamas and trying to bring back hostages. So you got that right off the bat. You have a significant portion of your, you know, sort of coalition, your Netanyahu, that either claim the turf that Hamas claims to control or wants to claim other Palestinian turf and use the conflict as a way to do that, you're going to quickly get into a more of a total war scenario that in the context of the kind of urban and tunnel warfare that they're having to prosecute in the Gaza Strip is going to lead to a much higher number of civilian casualties and get you stuck in, you know, a sort of never-ending conflict where the only actual end to this thing is basically like, you know, something approaching the annihilation of the Gaza Strip and its control by the Israeli state. And I think that's how you end up with these, like, on the face of it, they kind of look similar, but then you're like, well, if you walk the objectives through, you wind up with two just really different outcomes.
Well, the dissonance between objectives and outcomes is very much brings us back to Le Carre territory, the dilemmas of morality, and so on and so forth. A practical question. I've heard that the CIA's review board, a publication's review board, asks you to change the name or eliminate the name of a communications program.
Yeah. Yes, they did. Not in this one. Not in this one, but in a past novel. Yeah.
Oh, do tell.
Which is kind of ironic because you know, years ago, and the CIA's Iran network was rolled up by the Iranians because of a failure in a communications program. It has been reported quite authoritatively. I've reported it as well years ago. Anything else they asked you to change?
So let's see. Yeah, they had me change the name of, I think the one you're referencing was from Damascus Station, my first novel, where they asked me to remove the name of an instant messaging program that we use at the agency, which would be well known to everybody, but I guess the contract for that, you know, is classified in some way, shape, or form, and so they didn't want that out there. In my second novel, Moscow X, I got into an appeals process with them because they wanted me to remove references to Russia House from the book.
And what do you mean? Like they didn't want you to report that it existed?
Oh, come on. That's been widely cited in books and movies.
No, exactly. Come on. Exactly. So anytime Russia House appeared, they blacked it out. And I went back to them and said, I said, look, you know, my understanding, this was my initial appeal, which didn't work. I said, my understanding is that this isn't on the org chart and that this is actually just a direct lift and shift from the Le Carre novel, which I believe came out in 1988. And everyone inside, I think what was then CE division, said, well, that's cool. Let's call ourselves Russia House. And so it just kind of was adopted, right, from the novel. And that didn't go anywhere. But what did go somewhere was there's another former colleague of mine who writes kind of humorous spy novels. And I remembered, thanks to another one of my agency friends who had read the book, that she goes through the PRB, the Public Review Board, and she had referenced Russia House in her book, and it had been out only, you know, a year or two at that point. And so I sent a snapshot of the page and said, my understanding is that this went through the PRB. So if it did, just please tell me what's changed in the year and a half since. And they responded back pretty quickly. And to their credit, I would say, they said, fine, you can say Russia House. And so I left Russia House in.
You got to write a scene like that into one of your novels.
Yeah. Your next novel has to be about a former CIA guy writing novels.
And trying to go through the PRB. Yeah, no, the PRB, though, I will say, to their credit, very fast, very efficient. When I call them, if I send something to them, I try to call them and say, you know, this is coming and here's kind of my rough deadline. They're pretty fast. But it is, depending on who gets it, who picks it up there, it can be, it's a little capricious, let's say, right. how they edit it.
Right. So in the book, I mean, you portray the Mossad as, pulling off some pretty daring, aggressive operations, which does track in real life, like the pager operation was extraordinary from an intel perspective, the amount of work that went into that and how they concealed the origin of the pagers through multiple cutouts. You know, when I first started covering the CIA many decades ago, the rap was risk averse. And that certainly amplified after 9/11. Things have come and gone. But I do wonder, you know, where things stand today. We have a new CIA director, John Ratcliffe, but his predecessor, Bill Burns, highly respected State Department official for years, but he was a diplomat. Yeah. And I just wondered, I mean, is the CIA today, you know, capable of planning, pulling off the kinds of operations that you write about that the Mossad has done and continues to do?
Well, I would probably say right off the bat that there's a good reason we don't do a lot of operations like the Mossad does. And the reason for that is that we don't live in the Middle East. We do not have the same, frankly, existential struggles that the Mossad perceives it has and that the Israeli state perceives it has. And so as a result, I think our risk tolerance should be lower than Mossad's. And that a lot of the operations that I lay out in the Persian, it's probably good that the U.S. taxpayer isn't funding those and absorbing.
But we do live in a dangerous world with
we do
sophisticated adversaries.
We do. And I think, you know, I think a lot of the answer to your question, like kind of looking forward, is, you know, are we able and willing, I guess, to really penetrate the decision-making circles inside places like Tehran and Moscow and Beijing and Pyongyang, to understand, maybe less to shape, because I think when the Israelis are doing operations, you know, this is one of the other differences that came out between the agency and Mossad as I was doing research for the book, is that the CIA might be very interested in an Iranian nuclear scientist, and we're interested for the purposes of collecting FI, foreign intelligence. Does that scientist have insight into the Iranians' race to a bomb, the plans and intentions and thinking around, you know, the value of a weapon, how it might be used, where the hurdles are, all that? The Israelis are interested in all of that. And on top of it, the Israelis like to know things like, where does that scientist sleep at night? What is their pattern of life? You know, what kind of car do they drive? What kind of security detail do they have? Because in the back of the Israelis' mind at all times in those kind of targets is, we need to be prepared to kill them. And the CIA doesn't have the same perspective, you know? So that's just a little bit of an aside on how the two services think differently. But I think for the standpoint of the agency, the question is, you know, can we give U.S. policymakers, can we run the kinds of daring operations that would be necessary and invest over the long term so that we have a much better sense of what the Chinese are thinking and what the Russians are thinking and what they're going to do next? And that one, I think, is a big, that's a big open question looking forward for the agency is, do we have not just the risk tolerance, but kind of the stamina and the kind of the ability to fund and resource and keep our eye on that ball over multiple administrations? That's a big open question.
And our objective here, you know, being how many thousands of miles away from the Middle East, is not to be killing people, but to find somebody who can steal a memo off a prime minister's desk. A lot of this can be done today with AI-driven cyber offenses, and increasingly so, and that's just really not even reached its pinnacle yet. But there's no substitute for the guy who's actually talking to Putin or Xi Jinping, who can tell us what the opposition leader's thoughts are. So
I agree.
We've talked a lot on this podcast and in Spy Talk, the site, about the weaponization of intelligence and law enforcement in this administration. And, you know, between Tulsi Gabbard and John Radcliffe, there have been, you know, they stripped people of their security clearances, fired people, done things that are, you know, virtually unprecedented, at least in American intelligence. And, you know, the big question is, you know, what impact from a national security perspective is all that having? You're still talking to some of your former colleagues to the extent that you have a finger on the pulse of what's going on in Langley. Give us your perspective on what you've been witnessing from this administration.
That's a good question, Mike.
Well, that's why I asked.
So I will not claim to have my finger on Langley's pulse by any stretch. It's a big place. There are, you know, I think the place largely mirrors a lot of the sort of political realities that we face in just the broader society. So we have a lot of people who work at the Central Intelligence Agency who voted for Donald Trump, and a lot of people at the Central Intelligence Agency who voted against him, right, and voted for Kamala Harris. So, like, I think, you know, there can sometimes be a tendency when we create our mental model of the place, particularly in the wake of, you know, Trump 2.0 taking office, to kind of think it's a unified entity where, you know, it sort of sees itself as under assault from the Trump administration. And I do not think that that's true. Right. I think it's very mixed. What I will say is that I do have friends and colleagues who are there who felt in the wake of the second Trump administration that there was sort of a chill in the air with respect to what you could say. Right. And deep uncertainty about whether the administration really wanted to do kind of a massive layoff, or if you're on the other side of that issue, a purge, right? I heard from other officers who said, look, Langley is fat, you know, headquarters is fat after 25 years of the war on terror. It's gotten big. It's not gotten big in the field. It's gotten big at home in kind of, you know, a way that, a big bureaucracy could get big, and that could be a U.S., you know, federal agency. It could also be a big kind of private company, right? Or, you know, a publicly traded company, Fortune 500 company that's just gotten fat and needs to do a downsizing. So you have people who think, hey, it's too big. You have others who say, where's the evidence for that? So you kind of have this more complicated back and forth, I think, that's gone on inside the workforce around whether the place is too big. You do have some examples of what I think are worrisome signs or worrisome indications of kind of growing politicization, right? You could see this with, there was a dismissal of an officer on the National Intelligence Council whose name I'm now blanking on. There was the push for the analysts to come up with a better answer on the connection between what was it?
Trendyago.
Mexican gang. Yeah. That gang and the Venezuelan government.
Yeah.
And then there was the kind of bizarre, I think, use of a low to no confidence intelligence assessment on the COVID lab leak theory that was kind of publicized by Director Ratcliffe in the early days of the administration to show that, you know, hey, this has always been a lab leak. The CIA has always had this, and now I can finally put this information out there, which is not sort of politically motivated use of the intel, right? You also have examples like the gang connection to the Venezuelan government is an example where it seems like the analytic cadre stood their ground and said, this is the assessment.
Well, that was the National Intelligence Council chief, whose name was Mike Collins, who got fired by Tulsi Gabbard because he put out a product that contradicted what the administration was saying about Trinidad Aragua.
Yeah, exactly. So
you
got to
wonder
whether
specifically Ukraine, because there's been so much skepticism within the MAGA community and so on about aiding Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is almost entirely dependent on U.S. intelligence for its targeting and its defenses in many cases for paramilitary operations. We give a lot of support to the Ukrainians, and the agency, of course, is right in the middle of that, is the tip of the spear. So you got to wonder whether those operations will be cut back under the regime.
Yeah, no, and you know, I think what all of this to me suggests, I mean, this is just me looking at it from the outside, right, and talking with some people, but this isn't some comprehensive view. It's just as I knit these little data points together, what it looks like is a quite chaotic and sometimes random sort of periodic assault on the agency or on the national security bureaucracy based on political motivations from, you know, people like Laura Loomer. It's not
state stuff.
It does not look, I guess what I'm not seeing evidence of yet is, for example, okay, what I would have feared is the administration takes a very political figure off of maybe the campaign and puts them inside the Eastern Europe, you know, sort of Eurasia Mission Center at CIA, which covers Russia and contains Russia House, and says, you're going to go in here and you are going to make sure that the assessments that come out accord with the Trump administration's line. Like, they could have done that. They didn't do it. You know, so it's more subtle and chaotic, I think, than that at this point.
They put Tulsi Gabbard as the director of national intelligence. She was a political figure, a congresswoman who was a mouthpiece for Assad, a tyrant you know well as the Syrian analyst.
I mean, apologist for Putin.
Yeah, totally.
How is that any different, in fact, on a larger scale, than the scenario you just said you feared?
Yeah, so I draw. Here's where I draw. I totally agree with you on the Gabbard take. By the way, I mean, I think you don't even need to bring in her bizarre/reprehensible views on what the Assad regime did to think that she's she was not qualified to run, you know, to be the DNI. Right? I mean, she'd never run any bureaucracy of note, anything large. Like, there's a whole bunch of sort of disqualifiers even before you get to that stuff. But I agree with
and
you.
She
totally.
Is. She is the nominal chief of U.S. intelligence.
Nominal, yeah. What I was most concerned about was a kind of a concerted effort to actually drive those political impulses deeper into, let's just take the CIA to make it less complicated, to drive those political impulses deeper into the CIA to do things like putting essentially political appointees, you know, inside mission centers to be regularly kind of twisting the analysis to suit the administration's political ends, and or to have conducted a much broader, frankly, purge of the organization to get rid of people that don't toe the line. You can find evidence of all of that in a very kind of scattershot manner, and it's happened. You can point to it. But the lack of any kind of systematized effort, I find in this context to be encouraging, because to me it's like, it's almost too
well,
it's
early.
Almost too chaotic. It is early.
Only 8 months into, or what? How many months?
We should be encouraged by their incompetence, is what you are arguing, I think. Yeah.
That's territory for your next novel.
Yeah. By the way, do you still have a security clearance?
I do not. No. No.
Okay, because I would say after this podcast, you probably
I will not. I won't be getting one. Yeah, I will not be receiving okay. one. I can guarantee you.
With that, we do really do have to wrap it up. I predict that The Persians is going to be a big success and is going to vault you even more into the stratosphere of spy thriller writers, into that vaunted Le Carre territory, which you've already entered. So I've enjoyed every book you've written.
I think this is
great stuff. This is written by someone who really knows or has learned about how the intelligence world works. So congratulations on that. And I hope everyone will get to this, The Persians, and read it. So thanks, David McCloskey, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This was a ton of fun.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isgoff.
We'll see you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance, or don't understand the differences between insurance plans, or have surprise medical bills, out of control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.